Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We all know real life can suck sometimes, and your boss accidentally seeing you in your underpants on Zoom last week doesn't help any.
That's why reluctantly codependent sisters, the Shira and Rishalia, keep you enthralled and in stitches every week with their podcast, Legendary Africa.
Every Monday and Friday, we take you on a journey of mythical lands, magical objects, and monstrous creatures, both ancient and modern.
Find Legendary Africa on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you feed your ears. And remember, stay safe,
stay sexy,
and stay legendary.
Hello and welcome to the Monster Legends Podcast. I'm your host, Tanner. In this episode, we'll be talking about the monsters in Connecticut. But as always, let's start with a little history lesson. It's from history.com and was published on August 21st, 2018. One of the original 13 colonies and one of the six New England states, Connecticut is located in the northeastern corner of the country. Initially, agricultural community, by the mid-19th century, textile and machine manufacturing have become the dominant industries. The home of Eli Whitney and Samuel Colt, Connecticut was the leading manufacturer of guns and other arms. Today, Connecticut lies in the midst of the great urban industrial complex along the Atlantic coast, bordering Massachusetts to the north, Rhode Island to the east, Long Island south to the south, and New York to the west. Hartford, in the north central part of the state, is the capital, which, by the way, like most state capitals are like in the middle of the state. Like, it's more like a military thing. Yeah, you notice that? A state is roughly rectangular in shape, with a panhandle extending to the southwest on the New York border. In area, it is the third smallest U.S. state, but it ranks among the most densely populated. The state's greatest east-west length is about 110 miles, and its maximum north-south extent is about 70 miles. Connecticut takes its name from an Algonquin word, meaning land on the Long Tidal River. Not mistake, Constitution State and land of state habits are all nicknames that have been applied to Connecticut. Connecticut being a state on January 9th, 1788. The capital is Hartford. It has a population of 3,574,097 people, according to a 2010 census. It is 5,544 square miles in area and size. It is nicknamed the Constitution State, Nutmeg State, Land of Safe Habits, and Provision State. The state motto is Qui Transtulit. I can't freaking say Latin. Qui Transtulit Sustinent. He who transplanted still sustains. The state tree is the white oak. The state flower is the mountain laurel. The state bird is the American robin. Take a breath. The Fundamental Orders was the first constitution to be adopted by the American colonies in 1639. It established the structure and boundaries of the newly formed government and ensured the rights of free men to elect their public officials, principles that were later embraced with the U.S. Constitution. During a candlelit dispute that occurred when Sir Edmund Andros attempted to seize Connecticut's royal charter by order of King James II in 1687, the lights went out and the charter was whisked away to safety amid the chaos. Captain Joseph Wadsworth hid the charter inside a grand white oak tree, which became a symbol of freedom and later the official state tree. Benedict Arnold, whose name has become synonymous with the word traitor, as he expired with the British to turn over the post at West Point in exchange for money and a command in the British Army, was born in Norwich, Connecticut. In 1781, he led British troops in the Battle of Groton Heights, which devastated New London, Connecticut. The construction of Connecticut's old state house was completed in 1796. In 1814, it hosted the Hartford Convention, a meeting of various leaders in which the adoption of seven proposed amendments to the Constitution were considered by Maine to be treasonous. Connecticut and Rhode Island were the only two states that failed to ratify the 18th Amendment, which prohibited the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcohol. Yeah, they'll get fucking booze, man. Stupid. USS Nautilus, the world's first nuclear submarine, was constructed in Groton, Connecticut between 1952 and 1954. Much larger than its diesel-electric predecessors, it traveled at speeds in excess of 20 knots and could remain submerged almost indefinitely. because its atomic engine required only a very small quantity of nuclear fuel and no air. After 25 years of service, the Nautilus was decommissioned and opened to the public as an exhibit in Groton. The Connecticut-born revolutionary soldier and spy Nathan Hale was hanged by the British in 1776, became Connecticut's official state hero in 1985. Nathan Hale. Is he the guy from freaking Assassin's Creed 3? Yeah. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Anyway, alright, let's get into these monsters now. And it's from DamnConnecticut.com by Ray Benici. It was published in November 2015. It's titled Jewish City Vampires, Griswold. When people think of early New England, one of the many things that comes to mind are infamous witch trials of the late 17th century, of which Connecticut was quite an active participant, with more than 40 people tried as witches and at least 10 of them executed. As the action of those earlier events indicates, during the dark times in our state's history, the belief in and fear of supernatural creatures was quite strong. Not only were witches a source of concern, so was the devil himself, evidenced by no less than 34 places in Connecticut named in his honor, as it were. Its general sense of apprehension in regard to the supernatural was so deep-rooted and powerful that nearly 200 years after the last supposed witch was hanged, people were still paranoid and somewhat ignorant enough to believe that states could be besieged by vampires. And in this fertile breeding ground of fear, in the year of 1854, where the renowned tale of Jewish City Vampires take place, Dracula would not be published by Bram Stoker for another 40 years. The type of parasitic entities that Connecticut residents thought existed were not the debonair romantic bloodsuckers of fiction, far from Count Vlad, Edward, or Lestat. The vampires in the mid-19th century were thought to be the undead, arisen zombie-like from the grave to find nourishment in the blood of family members. In this particular case, the family was the Rays of Jewett City, who over the course of 9 years lost multiple family members to consumption, which is now known as tuberculosis. First to die from the mysterious disease was 24-year-old son, Lamal, in 1845. Less than 4 years later, family patriarch Henry B. Ray was felled by the same disease. He was followed to the grave in the same manner by 26-year-old son, Alicia, only 2 years afterward. 3 short years later, in 1854, eldest son Henry became stricken with the now all too familiar symptoms. That is when the true panic set in. Now convinced that they were dealing with something well beyond normal disease, the family somehow decided that the untimely demise were being caused by the dead relatives arising from the grave during the night and turning to feast on blood of the living. Something drastic needed to be done, and done quickly. According to newspaper accounts of the time, it was this pure intent of protecting the living that the decomposing bodies of Lamal and Alicia were dug up and burned immediately. Although it appears the body of Joseph Sr. was spared, it was believed that the incendiary action did the trick. History does not record a specific date for Henry's demise, so it's thought that he survived his affliction. Interestingly, evidence was discovered in the 1990s that there may have been other earlier suspected vampires outside the very family. In neighboring Hopeville, 29 graves were unearthed in a marked cemetery of the Walton family, who lived only 2 miles from the race farm about 50 years earlier in the early 18th century. Upon archaeological examination, it was determined that one of the bodies, which had been decimated by consumption, had apparently had been dug up after it was buried, had its head removed, was left of the skeleton face down, and its finger bones crossed over the chest. Other Walton family members had also evidently died from consumption. This is only speculation, but it seems as though if the consumption started ravaging the Rays, someone probably had recalled that a similar situation had befallen the Waltons decades before, taking cues from how the Waltons had stopped their vampiric epidemic. The same type of tried and true preventive action, i.e. re-killed the dead, may have been employed by the Rays. It seems as though there were other cases throughout New England where this kind of action had occurred, as chronicled in Michael E. Bell's Food for the Dead on Trail of New England's Vampires. It may seem extreme in retrospect, it wasn't necessary, but making extra sure dead stay dead made everyone feel better. That doesn't suck, right? And, I found an article on these Jewish City Vampires. It says pretty much the same thing as that one, but it goes on to say that the graves were found by two kids. Yeah, that one's from Weekend Weird. by Greg Newark, July 17th, 2016. Okay. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Legends Podcast, you can find the Monster Legends Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Legends Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Legends P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlegendspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Go to the next one. This one's not really a monster, but it's like a apparently really big guy, really big thing in Connecticut. Legend of the Leather Man. Hold on a second. All right, I'm back. Okay, the Leather Man. One of the most interesting pieces of Westchester County folklore is the living legend of the Leather Man. The true story of the Leather Man is still shrouded in mystery and controversy. However, even though we may never know the full story of this real person, numerous anecdotes and facts have been collected over the years, and new stories about him are still emerging now. Having been kept part of the oral history by various families within his territory, there is even a recent book about Leather Man, written by Dan DeLuca, that sheds some new light on the man. Though not purporting to be a full documentation of his life, the information contained on his site may clear up some of the questions that visitors to the War Pound Ridge Reservation may have about the Leather Man. In and around the time of the Civil War, around 1816, there were harmless and necessary wanderers roaming the countryside, usually looking for work on various farms or perhaps a meal or place in a barn for the night. During this period, there appeared an area of eastern Connecticut in Westchester and Putnam County, New York, a wandering hermit who was not to be forgotten. He came to the doors of farm kitchens, presenting a striking appearance with his homemade leather outfit, asking for neither work nor lodging, but making it clear that he would accept a meal. He did not speak, but seemed to mumble incomprehensibly, and made an impression on those who were generous to him by returning regularly every month or so for another visit, and he kept these regular visits up all the year round, farmsteads, in some cases for more than 25 years. Gradually, though, research of reporters and word of mouth, it became clear that this strangely attired figure, who kept his inner world to himself, was indeed covering a large area of territory in his wanderings, completing a regular circuit in Connecticut that covered the route from north of Danbury toward Waterbury, and following towns along the Connecticut River to Long Island Sound, and then starting west, largely tour around New Haven and Bridgeport as far as Newark, where he headed towards New York State by way of New Canaan and Wilton. Thus, it appears that in between his Connecticut circuit, he would visit Westchester and Putnam counties, visiting such towns as Purdy's Kinscope Village, South Salem, Croton Falls, Yorktown, Shelby Oak, Bedford Hills, and Briarcliff. It appears that occasionally, he continues on Island Sound route, visiting such towns as Greenwich, Rye, and Mamaroneck, a more southerly entry into the county. One estimate of his full journey was that his route covered approximately 365 miles and took him over a month to do, including about 240 miles through Connecticut and 125 miles through New York. The Leatherman's timetable was set up so that he arrived in a separate locality each day. Timing was so exact that housewives along this path could set their clocks by him. There are several features of the Leatherman's life and appearance that give us a deeper understanding of his identity and personality. The easiest was his preoccupation with leather, his hermit-like existence in local caves, his craving for tobacco, and his remarkable appetite. It is clear that the Leather Man was obsessed with leather. He would visit harness shops, accept donations of leather scraps, which he sewed together himself into his outlandish outfit. His clothing consisted of a leather hat with a visor, a pair of trousers which went up well to his chest, held by suspenders, a leather greatcoat extended just over the knees, and a pair of wooden-soled shoes with leather tops. He also had a bag of leather and carried a cane. In the winter months, he wore a scarf under his coat. His costume, weighing a mere 60 pounds, presented a patchwork effect, and the leather lacing was rather crude in his workmanship. They say that one could hear the leather creak as he walked by, and there were some that said you could smell the Leatherman coming. Of particular interest to our story is Leatherman's footwear. The clogs that he made closely resemble a type of wooden and leather shoe sabots worn by the peasants of northern France and Belgium. The Leatherman seemed to prefer keeping to himself, living alone in caves or rock shelters that he discovered on his route at regular intervals. He kept his cave very neat with a pine bough or leaf bed, with a fresh supply of wood always stacked up for his next visit. He did not hunt or fish to anyone's knowledge, and his interest in caves seems to be part of the withdrawn behavior. Some of the more well-known caves that he used in Westchester include Bulls Hills Cave in Bedford Hill behind the Mobile Station, Heckler's Cave in Armonk just beyond the Bowling Alley, and Leatherman's Cave at War Pound Ridge Reservation near Honey Hollow Road. The Leatherman smoked a pipe and enjoyed his tobacco. He picked up cigar butts along his way and gradually accepted offerings of fresh tobacco or cigars. Townfolk would press to his hand as he walked silently through the villages. Perhaps due to his constant smoking towards the end of his life, he developed a severe lip cancer, which ate away the side of his cheek, apparently causing him much discomfort and possibly being one of the main causes of his death. Leatherman was known to eat whole loaves of bread, boxes of crackers, all at one sitting, and loved his coffee, which is the only food he took for himself at his campsites. Several families mentioned that they looked so forward to regular visits of Leatherman. The wives baked especially for his arrival, sometimes even giving him an extra loaf, which he would put in his bag. Another important part of Leatherman's personality worth mentioning is that he never harmed a soul, and under his rather terrifying appearance was a harmless and gentle person. He is known to have lost his temper only a few times, shaking his cane and shouting at children who pelted him with rocks. An understandable response, however. What was it that drove this man on his lonely itinerary, and why was he so obsessed with leather? The answer to those questions may never be known, but a story did appear in a local paper, the Waterbury Daily American, that purported to be the true revelation of his identity. The story has never been verified and was even retracted by the very newspaper that published the claims not long afterwards. The disproven story is that the Leatherman was a Frenchman known as Jules Bourglais of the city of Lyon. Allegedly, when younger, the young man had a promising career in a leather factory and was engaged to the factory owner's daughter. Due to a severe oversight on his part, he either accidentally tipped over a Latin lantern late one night and burnt the factory down, or another version said he made a serious error in the accounts, which he kept, causing a big loss to the business. A story says he lost his job and was disowned by his fiancée's father. Having lost all his hopes in life, he took a packet boat to America and became the Leatherman, doing penance for the rest of his life and following an existence of torturous isolation and self-imposed physical hardship. It is a good tragic story, and has been part of the legend for a long time, but newspapers that made up the story retracted it multiple times after publication, and has been demonstrated to be false by several authorities, including Dan DeLuca's 2008 book about the Leatherman. Mr. DeLuca has said his best guess was that Leatherman was of French-Canadian descent with possible Native American ancestry. The first point is purported by Leatherman's document travels as far as north as Montreal and Vermont in 1870, as well as the French prayer book found in his possession upon his death. The second point is more of an educated guess, as evidenced at various graves since he kept native herb and vegetable gardens. The Leatherman survived the blizzard of 1888. By the end of winter of 1889, he was found dead in his cave on the Dell Farm in Briarcliff. Because he was such a well-known personality, a coroner's inquest was held during which some interesting facts were brought to light. These facts give a clue to his identity. Leatherman's bag was examined at this inquest. It was found to contain leather working equipment such as scissors and awls, wedges, a small axe, and an extra axe head, and other equipment that made the sack unusually heavy considering the Leatherman carried this burden as he walked. Of much interest is the fact that the bag contained a small prayer book, which was in French. This piece of information, combined with the French-style footwear, may allow us to conclude that the Leatherman may well have been a Frenchman or French-Canadian. The Frenchman is buried in Sparta Cemetery in Ossining, New York. Headstone incorrectly identifying him as Jules Bourglais of Lyon, France, was placed on the grave by a local historical societies in 1953. For that, from 1889 to 1953, his only grave marker was a metal pipe, which may have been removed in the intervening years. Leatherman's grave site at Sparta Cemetery was exhumed in 2011, in an attempt to find and recreate his remains. No bones or evidence was found other than some nails, possibly coffin nails. The dirt and nails were recreated to another site at the cemetery, and the large headstone marked simply Leatherman was placed at the new site, replacing the 1953 stone marked with a name that was never his. Excavations were conducted in Leatherman's cave on the War Pound Ridge Reservation, and though no diagnostic artifacts were found that directly related to the Leatherman, the soil yielded a large quantity of grease that had penetrated quite deep into the cave floor, which was perhaps a vestige of Leatherman's cooking activities there. If you'd like to find out more about Leatherman, you can watch the Trailside Nature's Museum's documentation video at War Pound Ridge Federation Inquirer about bringing a school or scout group to the museum's Leatherman's field trip. The museum staff can provide information about hiking to his cave. Leatherman's loops 10-kilometer trail run is an held annually at the reservation after returning to him reflect upon the life of this most unusual man. In case you're wondering where you can listen to the Monster Lunch podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Okay, this is a story article from Hartford Current by Peter Matica. Hope we say your name right. Published August 21st, 2014. A mysterious creature that once haunted Glastonbury. It was a creature that let out blood-curdling yells at night. It was described as witnesses who saw it as a large dog with a cat-like face. Small dogs disappeared or were found mutilated along with goats and sheep. And so the legend of the Glastonbury Claw Walkus began. It was in the middle of a cold, snowy winter in 1939 when the Hartford Current ran a story of a hunting party that went into the wilds of Glastonbury in search of the creature. It was a headline writer's dream as the newspaper's front page read, "Gufus of Glastonbury, Glaucus Creek, gloomy gang of gunners." The search party turned up nothing. The Glaucus was still loose in the snow-covered hills of Glastonbury Tuesday night. Victor of the wilds of the best huntsmen in these parts read January 18th article, "Until they're sure, the scientific term of Glaucus will be used. Name come from Glastonbury and its habitat, and from Mackie to describe the way everyone feels about the whole thing. The ending makes it sound Latin and authentic." The Current printed a map showing the story, the area of the three big Glaucus hunts, and pinpointing bits of Glaucina areas where dogs and other domestic animals killed or mauled. Areas Glaucus heard howling, areas where Glaucus was seen, and dogs chased something locations. The sightings and hunts were confined to the wilderness portion of southern and eastern parts of town. Some believe the creature was a mountain lion that escaped from Manchester Vermont Zoo after the Great Hurricane of 1938. Because the animal is out of its native habitat, the animal is probably restless, Warren Charles Alhouse said. It might move on and port some distance away in a short time. However, it will probably stay around as long as there is the rabbits to meet the needs of mountain lion's habitat appetite. Others thought the creature may be a lynx. "I never saw a Glaucus," said a New Britain policeman in a January 23rd article. "But I'll bet this animal over there in Glastonbury isn't one. I bet it's a lynx. 4 years ago, there were two lynxes off here in the Pinnacle Mountains. They were mates, and nobody caught or killed them. You have a whole family around these parts by now." The lone hunter to see the creature was Hartfordite William F. Bonvolor? I don't know. Anyway, in a wilderness near Diamond Lake, when a beautiful black creature, about 3 feet long, with tail 2 feet long, leaped out of the scrubwood in front of them. One of them brought up his shotgun and cut loose with the right barrel, according to the Current article. The 12-gauge charge bit into a rotten tree stump as the star cat began zigzagging throughout the underbrush. A second shot misfired as the cat kicked back sprays of snow as it fled into a stretch of green cedars. But once a legend is born, it was hard to resist the pull of myth. There was a community dance called the Glaucus Ball. An article ran about the children making a Glaucus man in the snow. Hunting clubs made Glaucus hunters from members to shoot. Even local poets were inspired. The Glastonbury lion, or raw cat, where is he? Perhaps it's some poor tabby, now hiding in a tree. But if it's the great safari, its big game could not stalk through wood and open landscape, it had a lovely walk. The fever began to die down when a large brown dog was killed in July by hunters. The headline from July 7th, 1939 read, "Mysterious Glaucus is no more. Dog was taken in the baited bear trap, shot and buried in an unmarked grave. In a few days, the beast was caught and a bullet ended its suffering," read the article. A few persons witnessed the incident and they decided to bury the animal and say no more about it. After that, Glaucus was seen no more, and one by one, read a 1958 article marking the 20th anniversary. Glaucus man admitted the dog probably was a terrible monster. Well, maybe, perhaps. So others waited until Milltown farmers one night reported seeing a strange beast passing through that they said must have been him. Bottom line, the legend of the Glaucus sold in its newspapers and brought some excitement to Sleepy Town during a long winter. It revealed the monotony relieved monotony of a dreary winter. On July 8th, the editorial noted, it provided small talk for uncounted dinner tables just as the subject of the hurricane began to pall. It got any member of ordinarily slothful individuals into the open air. Now it is dead, but if one knows Glastonbury, it will rise again. It was too useful to remain long buried. Here's more on the Glauwakas from the Cryptid Wiki. The Glauwakas is a creature seen in Glastonbury, Connecticut, and Fizzleburg, Massachusetts, and it's in the tradition of lumberjacks. In the latter incident, it's reported to have attacked livestock. It's said to have a strong resemblance to a mix between a bear, panther, and lion. An eyewitness report states that I was working as a young reporter on the Hartford Courant that year when World War II was in the wings. We were preoccupied with the developing story about this Glastonbury creature that howled at night, slipped in and out of view, and caused dogs, cats, and small farm animals to disappear. As sightings grew in number, so did the varied descriptions. First, there was a huge cat. Then some people reported it what looked like a dog in back and a cat in front. Others said it vice versa. One man called to say he had seen a big animal in a pitched bark with eyes that glowed like embers. It was clear to us that this weird unknown animal needed a name. One editor coined the word Glauwakas, Gla for Glastonbury, Wack for Wacky, us as a proper Latin ending. It caught on like magic, and Safari was organized with two Ozark trained pounds, but was unsuccessful. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Okay. Walkers. Okay, next one. Someone by CT Files, Legend of the Wested Wildman by Ray Pedinci, published February 11th, 2015. It's hard not to smile when you start writing about Bigfoot, the legendary ape-like creature that supposedly stalked the forests of North America for centuries. The hairy and conveniently reclusive hominid is mostly associated with the wilds of the Pacific Northwest, but it has allegedly been seen in every state and nation, including Connecticut. That's right, over the past century or so, Sasquatch has been reportedly spotted more than a dozen times here, mostly in the woodsy northern reaches of Litchfield County. Although there has never been exceptions, one 1953 encounter with a 7-foot tall creature covered in dark brown hair, the primate's face, and arms down its knees was reported in the White Hills region of Shelton. And in 2013, the inexplicably popular Finding Bigfoot TV crew came to Connecticut to investigate a sighting, although it was generally believed that it had only been a camera-shy black bear. In that vein, our favorite unofficial Bigfoot-like legend is that the Winstead Wildman, which terrorized locals on two separate occasions, almost 80 years apart, you know, if you believe the stories. The tale starts on August 27th, 1895, when the Winstead Evening Citizen ran a story which also ran the next day in his sister publication, the Winstead Herald, claiming that large man, stark naked and covered with hair all over his body, ran out of a clump of bushes. It was witnessed by town selectman Riley Smith, who was picking out blueberries in the area of Colebrook with his faithful bulldog Ned, when the encounter occurred. Something had spooked the hound, causing it to whimper and come crawling with the tail between his legs. Moments later, the wild man emerged, cried out, and scrambled off at lightning speed. Both Smith and Ned were paralyzed with fear. A few weeks later, the Herald ran a following-up story in which Smith described as a man talks but little and of undoubted pluck and nerve. His word is first class, provided more details about the wild man, describing it as a wild, hairy man in the woods, 6 foot in height. He had the man's hair was black and hung down along his shoulders, and that his body was thick, covered with black hair. The man was remarkably agile, and to all appearance was a muscular, brawny man, a man against whom any ordinary man would stand little chance. Over the next few weeks, the wild man apparently continued to run amok, generating sensational paper-selling headlines, and both the Herald and a citizen, a local man named George Hawkins, reportedly saw the wild man stealing two chickens from his henhouse. Two women from New York claimed they saw a large, strange animal standing on tiny legs, possibly a gorilla, escape from some circus. They thought during a visit, local chief of police Steve Wheeler reported that they had sighted it and given chase before losing trail in a nearby swamp. And so the mania grew. One witness, Jim Madra, even boasted that he had snapped a picture of the mysterious man beast. Unfortunately, the photograph showed a normal man who, although had prodigious shock of hair, was otherwise not particularly hirsute. When questioned, Madra explained that the camera had been so startled by the wild man that it couldn't see straight. Word of the wild man spread, and soon reporters from across the region were descending upon Winston in hope of getting a glimpse. Eventually, a reward was offered for the wild man's capture. A search party, more than 100 men strong and well-armed, was organized and dispatched. Despite a thorough search, wild man was apparently a step ahead, managing an elude capture. At one point, the Hartford Sun-Day Globe speculated that the wild man may have been an escaped mental patient named Arthur Beckwith. Beckwith had really freed himself from local asylums to wander countryside au naturel and live off the land, never harming anyone but causing a bit of ruckus. Like so much of the wild man's tale, this was never confirmed. A science lesson over the ensuing weeks, reporters left and the wild man buzz slowly fizzed. The story was chronicled in the West End Wild Man and Other Tales, in a 1929 tome by Frank Wynne Wentworth. But as the decades passed, so did the wild man, from the public consciousness for a while anyway. In July 1972, the wild man allegedly reappeared after nearly 8 decades. The Harvard Courant reported that two young men observed a strange man-like creature on Winchester Road near Crystal Lake Reservoir. They claimed to have seen at a distance an overt hominid about 8 feet tall and covered with hair that eventually disappeared into the woods. When suggested that they may have seen a large bear, they replied, "It was no bear." 2 years later, in September 1974, the wild man was seen again, this time by two couples parked at night by Rug Brick Reservoir. They told the police they were terrified by witnessing a 6 foot, 300-pound creature covered with dark-colored hair in the moonlight. It had fled immediately, and subsequent search failed to turn up any evidence. Since then, there have been no official sightings of the Winston Wild Man. Of course, like all good legends, there doesn't seem to be a preponderance of actual facts or evidence to bolster the Wild Man's existence. Many of those who had researched the story tend to think that the original sightings by Riley Smith might have been greatly embellished or flat-out manufactured by the editor of the original Winston newspaper to spur sales during a slow news cycle, and then was banned by two mystic promotions by public panic and subsequent misidentification of bears and other more mundane woodland fauna. In other words, no one let the truth get in the way of a good and wild story. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at MonsterLensP. If you want to send an email, you may send it to MonsterLensPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. This one's the little thing about the Maskawasigu from NativeLegends.org. These are pronouns referred to in the race of little people, singular pronouns referring to one such creature as our Maskawasigu. Production from the Mohegan Pequot tribes, but usually Musqueam are the little people of the Mohegan and Pequot tribes. They can be dangerous if they are disrespected, but are generally benevolent nature spirits. Musqueam are traditionally described as knee height, around 2 feet tall. The name Musqueam derives from the Mohegan Pequot word for the whippoorwill bird, which they are associated. Musqueam are said to be carved symbols on rocks and have magical powers, including the ability to make themselves invisible. The lizard Musqueam, Granny Squat, is a powerful magician married to the cultural hero Masuwap. And it's a story of the little people of Musqueam, little people. Okay. The rocks of Mohegan Hill are the homes of the Makiawasu, or little people. After nightfall, the call of this whippoorwill signals their arrival. They are good spirits. The Mohegans know they must be treated with respect. According to tradition, it is important to leave baskets of food such as corn cakes and berries, or even meats in the woods for them. Wearing muskin flowers or shoes, they gather the gifts at night. In fact, Musqueam means whippoorwill muskin. They have their own rules of etiquette. Those who see the little people do not directly look at them. They think it's rude. If they catch you staring, they might point a finger at you, bring you to the ground while taking you or blinds. Another rule is don't speak of them in the summer when they are most active. When returning for kindness, they taught the people how to grow corn and use healing plants. They keep the earth well and grant favor for those who honor their ways. When the English settlers came and disrupted the traditional way of Mohegan life, many forgot to help the my key on Muscovite. As a result, many Mohegans and Muscovite fell ill. At this time of bad spirits, there lived a medicine woman. One night, during a terrible storm, she heard a whippoorwill. When she looked outside, the bird wasn't to be found, but a small boy stood in the rain on her doorstep. It turned out he was a grown Muscovite named Wiegand, who told her to come help someone who was sick. Though the storm was fierce, he led her through the woods a long way. Suddenly, the storm seemed to stop. As it began to descend into the ground, there were in the realm of the little people. Wiegand led her to a beehive-shaped chamber of rocks. Inside, a very old woman lay in bed, very ill. The Muscovite told the medicine woman this was Granny Squinant, who must be made well. Granny Squinant is very powerful, and she is known to cause storms when she argues with her husband. Her illness was the reason for this storm. Worse, healers often look to Granny Squinant when the need is dire for help and healing. And here she was, the one who was sick. The medicine woman treated Granny Squinant for nearly a moon before she got better. In return for restoring Granny Squinant's health, the Muscovite gave the medicine woman a basket of gifts and told her to remember them. She was blindfolded and taken back home. Only when she returned did she open the basket. Inside were quartz crystals, painted skins, and bunches of herbs. According to the legends, Mohegans left baskets like this one shown above, filled with food, show respect for the little people. It's like a woven basket. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Okay, so recordjournal.com. Throwback Thursday, Legendary Black Dog of the Reading Hanging Hills by Ryan Chester, December 6, 2018. Hubbard Park is considered one of the Marine's greatest attractions, Castle Greg, which overlooks the peaks from above, is one of the highest points within 25 miles of the shoreline on the East Coast, offering beautiful views of New England. But as local legend has it, those beautiful views can be quickly turned to fatal ones once a black dog enters the frame. The first written account of the legend of the black dog of West Peak traces back to 1898, and the story has captivated residents and hikers of Silver City and beyond ever since. As the myth suggests, the black dog roams around the western regions of the Hanging Hills, where the Radio Tower currently stands. Canine makes no sound when it barks, nor leaves any prints in the ground when it walks. For those who venture into hills and spot the canine for the first time, it is believed to be a sign of joy. Seeing dog again, and that signifies sorrow. A third sighting means death. A story of the black dog was described in chilling detail in an 1898 article in the Connecticut Quarterly, authored by W.H.C. Pynchon? Most accounts believe that Pynchon was writing from his own experiences, but a Marine record story from 1949 suggests that Pynchon could have been retelling a story based on the experience of a mysterious unnamed man with initials F.S. However, a later archive from the Marine record in 1977 does state that it was Pynchon himself who encountered the black dog with deadly results. As the article in the Quarry goes, Pynchon, a geology student at Harvard, was hiking and studying the Hanging Hills when he saw a black dog who wound up following him for hours. Pynchon describes the dog as a short-haired black dog of moderate size, with nothing particularly noticeable in its actual appearance. Dog appearance events that followed were. Pynchon recalled the dog leaving behind no footprints, nor kick of any dust on what was a dry summer day. The dog mysteriously disappeared. Pynchon explained the experience to his friend, Herbert Marshall, of the U.S. Geological Society, who informed Pynchon of the local myth. Marshall even claimed to have seen the dog twice himself while in the area, though balked at the idea of the myth holding any truth. 3 years later, the two returned to the West Point Peak together for more study. While scaling the edge of one of its cliffs, there was the dog, looking down on them from the peak above. According to Pynchon, Marshall's face went white at the sight of the animal. "I did not believe it before. I believe it now. This is the third time," Marshall said to Pynchon, before Grok gave out at his feet. Marshall let out a cry forward, tumbling to his death. It was the third time he saw a dog. For Pynchon, it was his second. It was somebody's sorrow, and he had just watched his friend die. Pynchon wrote that he quickly sought to help of a group of men from nearby house, and the man claimed to have seen a black dog standing over Marshall's body when they went to retrieve it. Pynchon was officially a believer and acknowledged his fate in this article. "I know something. I shall see it again for the third and last time," Pynchon wrote. That third time came 6 years later, this time in the cold winter months, and Pynchon disappeared. According to an article in the New York Herald His body was found 10 days later, on almost the same spot where his friend Herbert Marshall met his death 6 years ago. According to the article, Patchen's death was the fifth that occurred near the area in the previous 30 years. Claimed sightings of the dog were less frequent after Patchen's death, but the legend continues. It can be found in Patricia Edwards Kahn's Ghostly Animals of America, published in 1977. David Phillips, a former English and folklore professor at Eastern Connecticut State University, would tell stories of the black dog to crowds in numerous public gatherings, including the Walford Public Library in late 1980s to mid-1990s. He also notes that stories in his book, Legendary Connecticut Traditional Tales from the Nutmeg State. Diana Smith, formerly of WTNH, previously did a four-minute news segment on the legend of the black dog storytelling nights at the Solomon Golfing House on North Colony Street around Halloween, which consists of rumblings of the black dog. A blogger even claimed that Meredith's resident had a photographic encounter with the dog back near Castle Greg in 2006. To this day, curious explorers still search West Peak, hoping to catch a glimpse of the legendary canine. Those who search out the black dog will never hear it coming, and if they see it, it will likely hope it's for the last time. In case you're wondering where you can listen to the Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. It's from damncanticut.com. Again, by Ray Medici, published December 2016. Sea monsters and servants line up Long Island Sound. With its maritime heritage, it is no surprise that Connecticut also had a rich history of sea monster and sea serpent sightings. For centuries, Connecticut has been dependent on the sea. Native Americans spent a great deal of time on the water, fishing and harvesting oysters. Once the first Europeans arrived, thousands of livelihoods have been made by fishing, lobstering, clamming, whaling, and catching other delicious water critters. Our coast has been critical to the settlement and development of the nation, not only because of the abundance of trading posts, but also due to its vital role in the shipbuilding industry. Literally thousands of ocean-going vessels have been launched from the shores of Connecticut. In short, we've been on the sea a lot. As such, scientists have been on the waves for hundreds of years. There have been numerous sightings of unusual creatures in the waters around Connecticut. Accounts of monsters being seen in New England's date back to 1638, when newspapers started being printed, such events began to be chronicled on a more regular basis. Like in much of the world where the sea plays an important role, there has been accounts of giant water snakes and squids, as well as more unusual creatures such as mermaids. The site detailing the history of lordship in Stratford had an excellent page dedicated to historical sea serpent sightings, as well as a mermaid sighting. Although the entire page is well worth reading, here are a few gems. From September 17, 1878, a sighting off the shore of Stratford by Mr. Kelly, a sober, trustworthy man, not far from the side of his vessel, he saw the head of a monster raised several feet above the waves. The hour above sunset was light enough to show the creature plainly. It was seemingly not 15 rods off. It was a horrible-looking head with a wide open mouth. The head disappeared and a portion of his body was shown, forming an arc along which it had been easy so far as space is concerned to have driven a team of oxen. There were several smaller curves, indicating a long body. The object disappeared in a few seconds before Mr. Kelly, standing alone in the midship gangway, could call anyone to see it. He described the body as being as large round as that of a big horse. July 18th, 1895. First person narrative of Captain Obadiah Donaldson, whose crew literally fought off a 60-foot wide octopus, 100-foot long arms after accidentally crashing into it. He was in a deep sleep, and the snores could be heard quite a way off. But I was too late. The boat shook him amidships. He woke in a jiffy. At first, he thought we were, but he rubbed his eyes and identified us as enemies. Though heaven know, I had no wish to find him. He darted at us, kicking up the sea. One of his long arms came aboard and seized the forward stem of windlass. He wound his arm around it, thinking, I suppose, that it was a sailor. The mate, with his great presence of mind, startled the windlass, and in less than time it takes to tell it a couple of hundred feet of the arms whirls round it, and we had to fish a prisoner. But we caught a tar. He ran to pull up the boat. I was afraid he meant to sink it and eat us at his leisure. The vessel rocked, and I thought we capsized every minute. I talked to Frank Taylor, the boatswain, to cut off the arms. He did so with a meat chopper. Eventually, the octopus was run off by a group of porpoises. July 18th, 1909. The tale of Stratford Lighthouse Keeper, who confronted an odd creature from the water, that was stealing his chickens. Pulling off the gun, Mr. Johnson let fly with both barrels. There were a great run of pain and the sound of some heavy body struggling on the sand, and all still. Getting a lantern, Mr. Johnson found on the beach a huge fish-like fish, like of which he never saw before. It resembled a flatfish or a skate, as much as anything, only it was nearly a yard long and was afterward found to be weigh 60 pounds. The beast was almost black in color, different from a flatfish that had a mouth that extended the entire width of its head. It was armed with large, sharp teeth, those of a shark. The mouth was distended, was large enough to accommodate a derby hat. One of the creature, in fact, extended a row of sharp spines with all over each eye, which was large as that of a human being. It was a filler, fully foot in length. The strange part of the whole fish was runs on the other side of two flippers, identically like those of a turtle. What the fuck is that? So, friends, I've not only been spotted in the Sound, as 1986 story from New York Times details are about how a 100-foot monster was encountered on the way up to Kennet River in Groundsville. From the story, out of the froth rose a big black head, as large as a flour barrel, and with eyes as big as small plates. The head kept rising higher and higher until 7 feet of the neck appeared. The man did not make a long, thorough examination, but they felt sure that the sea serpent must have been a clear 100 feet long. Arco goes on to say that fight many people coming out to see the creature was not seen again. Sometimes it wasn't always a pitched battle between man and beast. A witness in this July 3rd, 1881 article from the Times, when a yacht with a party of New London gentlemen came across a veritable sea serpent between Montauk and Block Island, who, as the yacht passed, he raised his head and took a survey of the surroundings. He was the color of golf weed, mottled with black spots, and was about 40 feet long. Apparently, the creature was out for a pleasure cruise like gentlemen aboard the ship. Obviously, many of these sea serpents are fall under the category of fictional fish stories, while others are most likely exaggerated descriptions of encounters with genuine out-of-place denizens of this ocean, such as oarfish or manatees. Of course, there's always a chance that a few stories are genuine. The ocean is a big place, of which I haven't even explored a fraction yet. Without any physical evidence, these reports will just remain stories. Although sea serpents sightings have declined drastically over the last century, unusual things are still seen from time to time. In October 2008, an unidentified creature was washed up on the New London beach, which drew a lot of monster speculation because it was essentially identified as a badly decomposed raccoon. Sadly, we have no particular monster associated with the state, say like Nessie or Champ, although we've heard tales about Trampy, a serious creature that haunts the Trap Falls Reservoir in Shelton. And by have heard tales, you mean have tried to fabricate our own urban legend to no success. Still, we continue to hear stories of sea monsters and other freakish water creatures. The Connecticut no longer has access to the coast, which won't be for a very long, long time. Despite countless hours laying about at Connecticut beaches, as well as occasional trip out on the Sound, we have yet to see any fierce sea beasties. If you go, the Connecticut coast and Long Island Sound are pretty much open to everybody. Send south from anywhere in the state, and eventually you'll hit the water. If you ever see any sea serpent or monsters frogging around the Sound, please let us know. Likewise, we'll post any pictures of unusual creatures spotted near our shores. It's an article by Natalie Clinton, March 24th, 2018. Few people know the frightening history of the giant river serpent in Connecticut. Tales of monsters living submerged underneath the Earth's waters are nothing new. The Loch Ness Monster is probably the most notorious aquatic legend around, but did you know the river serpent had been sighted quite a few times right here in Connecticut? The first recorded sightings of the Connecticut River Monster was documented in the New York Times in 1886. According to the publication, two men encountered the beast while in a small boat near Cromwell. The men reported that a sea serpent over 100 feet long hit their boats and threw them into the air. Unfortunately, they landed in the boat and were unable to safely return to the shore. In 1994, a sea serpent was again spotted near a bridge across the river. In an article in the Boston Herald, the monster was described as being a giant snake that was black with white stripes on its underside and rose out of the water 6 feet. There have been other sightings of the frightening river serpent since 1894, but the counts were not as close as the two previously described. Some people say it is all a big hoax, while others believe that anything is possible. Some residents think that the river serpent may have been its home in the whole river tunnel underneath our capital city, Hartford. If that's the case, who knows when the river might reappear on the river for all to see. Did you know about the river monster that has been sighted in the Connecticut River? you believe it's real or just a bunch of hogwash? Let us know your thoughts in the comment section. In case you're wondering where you can listen to Monster Lunch Podcast, you can find the Monster Lunch Podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podcasts, and Radio Public. If you want to submit your stories or keep updated on upcoming episodes, join the Monster Lunch Podcast Facebook group or follow on Twitter at Monster Lunch P. If you want to send an email, you may send it to monsterlunchpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Okay, this one's like the probably the most famous monster of Connecticut, I would say. The Melonhead from the New England Historical Society. Melonheads of Connecticut. Every New England town claim a ghost, and many have a witch in their past. But the Melonheads belong to only a handful of places in southwestern Connecticut. Melonheads live on the outskirts of town on heavily wooded country roads known as Melonhead Roads. Silent Hill Road, for example, is Mifflin Hill's Melonhead Road. Sawmill City Road is Tilton's. Melonheads also supposedly live on the outskirts of Monroe, Stratford, Seymour, Weston, Easton, Oxford, Southbury, Fairfield, New Haven, and Trumbull. They look like small humanoids with oversized heads. They rarely come out from hiding. It's thrive by eating small animals, stray cats, and human flesh, usually the flesh of teenagers. And for runaway teens or hikers who disappear, the Melonheads serve as a convenient explanation. Stories about deformed country people who keep to themselves go back at least a century to Europe. For example, a large family of Melonheads supposedly once lived in Bavaria, Germany in the mid-19th century. An immigrant family of Melonheads known as Wheelheads were said to live outside Rosbury, England around 1900. According to another theory, the term Melonhead may stem from Melungeon, which describes a mixed race people of Appalachia. They had an ancestry of European outcasts, freed slaves, and Native Americans, and they kept to themselves. Melonhead stories surfaced in Connecticut around after World War II, a time when people moved away from cities into suburbs. They probably reflect the New York ex-urbanites' prejudice and fear of isolated rural folk. But how did the Melonheads end up in Connecticut? One theory claims they came from a family accused of witchcraft and banished into the wilderness, where they survived and inbred. Through centuries of inbreeding, they mutated into Melonheads. According to another theory, the Melonheads escaped from Bayfield Hills Hospital, a now abandoned mental institution, or Garner Correctional Institute, which specializes in inmates with mental health problems. Both are in Newton, Connecticut. A variation on that theme has the Melonheads escaping from an untamed mental institution in the 1960s. Building supposedly burned, some of the inmates escaped and turned to cannibalism, which caused their heads to swell. Similar Melonhead stories also surfaced in Ohio and Michigan. An evil Dr. Crow supposedly conducted experiments on orphans in Kirtland, Ohio, once part of Connecticut. These children escaped, burned down the orphanage, and retreated into the woods. I mean, I heard about that story, I think. In Michigan, the Melonheads were children with androcephalies, abused in an insane asylum in Ottawa County, eventually released into the woods. Blue Granada. According to legend, back in the 1980s, a group of girls from Northern Dame High School in Bear Village crowd decided to drive around after a Friday night football game. Piled into a Blue Granada and ended up on Bellet Street in Trumbull. They looked for Melonheads. Girls parked their car, leaving the headlights on, and ventured into the woods. After they walked a couple of hundred feet, they heard the car door slam. The engine started, and the car headed towards them. You see the Melonheads inside, the size of children. They had large heads, rags for clothes, and orange glow in their eyes. Some say the Melonheads still drive around in that Blue Granada. Other less detailed stories describe mysterious figures in the woods. Workers who paved Sawmill City Road and children claimed they heard voices in the woods. Tree experts checking the woods for fungal infestation thought they saw strange figures lurking in the underbrush. The legend of the Melonheads isn't the only one to evolve deformed mutated humans in Connecticut. Also have the Denbury Frog People and the Faceless People of Monroe. Want to look for them yourself? Below is the list of Melonhead roads in southwestern Connecticut. Emmett's Road in Oxford, Bellet Street in Drumbill, and Monroe Road between Trashua Road in Drumbill and Judd Road in Monroe near the eastern border. Silent Hill Road in Milford, roads around Lake Michigan and Lake Mohegan in Fairfield, Regent Road in New Haven, Jeremy Swamp Road in Southbury, past roads in around Roosevelt Forest in Trafford. This is Danbury Frog People about. Urban Legends fandom. The Danbury Frog People are a family of strange mutant humanoids rumored to live in Danbury, Connecticut. Fairfield County Weekly ran a short mention of the Frog People in 1998, placed them in nearby Bethel. Frog People were described as possessing large, lemon-shaped heads with eyeballs on the sides, thin, crusty lips, and a wide mouth. and sucker noses and slit nostrils. They have patchy hair that set up upon their abnormally large heads, and their bodies are thin and gangly. There are several explanations as to what the creatures could be. Theories include extraterrestrials, a pygmy human subspecies. Most of these accounts from Connecticut native Mayor Brian Hines. The summer from my junior year of high school, a friend's mother was running a version of Meals on Wheels at a local church. I volunteered to help. Two friends and I would go around Dinsbury door to door to give out lunches to unfortunates. In one of my houses were the frog people. I share a family name I can't remember. They wouldn't come to the door, and we were told to knock on the door and then leave the food there. Meeting mischievous kids, we would hide and wait. I never got awesome views, but the door would crack open and a hand would come out. It was nest food. A year later, I'm at my local grocery store around 11 a.m. When the same two friends, we were walking down the canned foods aisle, and there, the frog person. He had penny loafers and a short sleeve dress shirt tucked into khaki pants. He's going through soups, we guess. He turned and saw us. I tell you what, it was not as horrific as grad. His head was lemon shaped. He had a bad, lazy eye. His face was sort of stretched. His eyes and nose looked far apart. Down syndrome? He had sores on his very thin lips. He really did not have a very foggy appearance, however. He had a normal head of hair. I'll go say it was even sort of nice, parted on the side. He had a bobblehead of sort appearance and was very gangly. The girl came around the corner, blonde hair, pretty well groomed. Then added to the creepiness of it. If you saw them from behind, they looked totally normal, but if you turn one around, it's a monster. I know it sounds mean, but they did look like two frogs. They darted away and quickly made their way out of the aisle. One of the most common legends about frog people is that they do not take kindly to outsiders. Okay, the spaceless people I'm talking about. Spaceless people.
It hurts. What the hell is that?
In the tiny town of Monroe, this is from OnFaceFandom.com. In the tiny town of Monroe in Fayetteville County, Connecticut, called by the locals the House of the Faceless People, legend has it that a group of unfortunates live in this old barn with one caretaker it's ever seen living or enduring. Presumably, the caretaker goes out only at midnight with his charges so they can at least get some fresh air. The sunlight is not favorable to those individuals who have no face, have no eyes, nose, or ears. It's a mouth outlined with pale lips and bony hands crashing around constantly and trying to find their way in the world.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Monster Legend Podcast. If you want to find more information about Monster Legend Podcast, go to monsterlegendpodcast.com or anchor.fm/monsterlegendpodcast. There you can find all episodes and platforms on which the podcast is on, which you can subscribe to. You also can email me with questions that will be answered on the show. Thank you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.